depends, possibly. The people who claim it as overwhelming the story, and it certainly could be. When I, you know, and I have students read a book written by a scholar who's not a Christian himself, but he argues, and he just sort of throws the Nestorians in and says that, you know, that I'm not going to, he says, I'm not going to judge, so we'll act like they're real Christians. Two things on that. One, not all Nestorians are Nestorian. They might take the name, but the instinct of the Nestorian might not be, it's not as bad as Arianism, let's put it that way. I'm not going to get into it. It's still a heresy, but it depends on what they mean. The Nestorian church broke away at Ephesus predominantly because they felt like they were unfairly treated. And so there have been a lot of folks that have carried on, I would think, within the bounds of orthodoxy, certain views, but they've gone on. But let's say for the sake of argument that the folks in China are Nestorian, hands down. What I tell my students is you still need the presence of orthodoxy to get the heresy. You still need there has to be reacting against something. So in Europe, for example, or in the same time, you have the explosion of Arianism as it leaves the Middle East and comes up here and takes over the Gothic tribes for a while. Well, they only really thrive because the Nicene faith is in Europe as well, and they have these fights. The trouble with the medieval Chinese church is we just don't know much about what happened. It's kind of like rumors and innuendos and some stats and a couple of things here and there, but we just don't have like theology books left behind by them. So usually it always ends up having a lot of speculation that we have to deal with. But yeah. Actually, yeah, the question. Arian and Nestorian in Islam, certainly the Arian. That was a shock to me, actually. I have the YouTube thing, what I've basically done, I'm a bit of an anarchist when it comes to free education. I made 4 fully online classes for the seminary, and I said, you know what, I at first I said I just want to house them on YouTube. Just have to be able to sign them. But then I realized, like, no, if you come to seminary, you're paying for the degree. The education ought to be free for everybody. You should be able to have, I mean, you can have access to that information all you want. So I put them up. And it's just been kind of this weird thing. But as of right, like today, it's like 6 million views of all the videos across the spectrum. I think 5 million are my mom, but, you know, still, it was a lot. But I have a video on Arianism and the creeds and the development there. And the number one comment I get is from Islamic folks who say, yes, Arius was a forerunner to us. And at least that has become the self-identity of certain comment. I don't know enough about the modern Islamic thinking on that. But at least there have been enough people who have said, yeah, that's he was right, that he signals this anti-Trinitarian Father Allah only theology, which becomes synonymous with Islam. Yeah. It wouldn't be Nestorian, though, because Nestorian believes it actually is the opposite opinion. It's that the divinity of Christ is so exalted. He is so truly equal with the Father that they come to the point where they have trouble reconciling that to the full incarnation of Christ. So they would say that the Son came alongside the man Jesus, but there wasn't an incarnation. So it would not mesh at all with Islam. They deny the divinity of Christ. Yeah. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, the Counter-Reformation. That's a great question. Historians love to hand-wring and feel bad about the way they used to do things. This is one of those areas. So in all of our textbooks for years, we used to have this chapter called the Counter-Reformation. Believe it or not, I'm writing that chapter now, finishing it, I should say. We've changed our language to be more broad. We now call it the Catholic Reformation, which is just like saying the positive elements that the Catholic Church was changing along with the Counter-Reformation. So the Counter-Reformation, historically, as it's understood, is obviously there had to be a response. What most people don't realize is how unwilling the Catholic Church was at any point in its history to reform itself. There's a famous Archbishop of Milan, Charles Borromeo. He is actually living during the time of the Reformation, And he is in Milan, at the time, the largest archdiocese in Italy. And he comes there, and he issues a call for reform. He had a bunch of fat, lazy monks and priests who didn't care about anything. And he says, stop spending money on all those luxuries, and let's get back to actual ministry, or at least the spiritual life. Again, we might challenge the type of reform, but he was serious about it. About a year or two into his reign, one of the local priests walked up. This is just not long after the incorporation of gunpowder into Europe. And he shoots him straight with him, like a little handheld musket. If he wasn't wearing the thick Catholic vestments, he would have been shot through the heart. But it went in and stopped, and he just got like a bruise on his chest. And the guy was arrested, and there was all that type of stuff. But that just shows you that even an internal reformer that's not a Protestant had a lot of uphill battle to try to get things changed. Two things predominantly changed, though, the Catholic Church. One was the rise of the Jesuits. Jesuits are the shock troops of the Reformation. They play a role in the assassination of the Dutch king, William of Orange, which is all during the rise of Calvinism in the Netherlands, that type of stuff. But they are committed, and in fact, the story of Jeremy Irons, the mission movie with Jeremy Irons and De Niro, there we go. I keep wanting to say Duvall, but he's the apostle. He's not in the mission. De Niro, they're Jesuit missionaries. So the Jesuits are one. The other one is the Council of Trent, because what happens is the Council of Trent doesn't meet until 1545, and it sits until 1560s. It takes off and on 20 years. But up until that point, it was believable that the Protestants might return. Trent, though, slammed the door. It's like two hands as hard as possible slamming the door to coming back. It says, so the Lutherans, Luther himself at least, had always believed that because he kept the physical body and blood of Christ in the Lord's Supper as his position, that the Catholic Church would see it as okay. They say, that's not even enough. You have to believe in our understanding of what that means. So, I mean, it is just a complete pushback. And from that point on, now it has to break up a lot of rocky ground, but the Council of Trent is the definition of Catholicism until the 1960s. It is no holds barred, no accommodation, language. Now, it doesn't mean they were all that way individually, but, you know, you get that intense, I mean, the kind of Catholicism you see in The Exorcist. I mean, that kind of stuff, the real hardcore, serious, anti-Protestant thing. That gave rise to a lot of challenges in this country where, I mean, Catholicism is the only faith for which there has been a political party established to try to throw them out. The Know-Nothing Party of the 1850s. It's called the Know-Nothing Party because it's slightly guerrilla warfare against Catholics. I mean, even in the liberal 1960s, JFK had to stand up and say, I'm not that much of a Catholic, you know, and to say, really he is, but he's not going to listen to the Pope. The Catholicism of North America has always been a little bit different in that way, but Trent at the Catholic Counter-Reformation is the biggest one. It slams the door to Protestantism, and it says basically, we'll get our house in order, and then they entered then into what we call the Catholic Renaissance, which is the Baroque period and lots of chamber music and things being funded and lots of buildings, Baroque buildings being funded. They really kind of what was the line? The best revenge is living well. That they kind of wanted to do that. They wanted to be better than a Protestant. Now, it's not just a negative story because for every Protestant community that not so much here, I don't think, but at least in North America, for every Protestant community that has had to go to the courts to allow for Christian education or homeschooling to exist, there were already on the books in most states laws that the Catholics had already won for that same right back 100 years ago. So there is a gratitude that ought to be established because they fought in a world where they didn't want to send their people to overwhelmingly Protestant public school. Now that it's overwhelmingly secularized, a lot of those statutes are on the books that allow us to do classical education, homeschooling, whatever it might be. Though people are trying to get it off the books in some states. So there's a long history there. Since the 1960s, it's the same Catholicism, it's just new PR. It's a kindler, gentler approach. So, for example, we Protestants got taken from schismatic heretics, that language, to ecclesial communities. That's what we're called now. Because we're not a church unless you are under a bishop. So you have a Catholic bishop. So to them it's being nice. You're an ecclesial community. You're not a church, but you still. It's better than schismatic heretics. But it's still the same position, which is, you know, we're separated. Yeah. All right. Well, it's is that it? Yes, sir. Very much relevant. Yeah, the question is the Pentecostal movement within Catholicism. The technical language would be the charismatic movement. This was drilled into me when I was in Assemblies of God. Pentecostal is the denomination. Charismatic, the adjective. But you know that. But it's at least always a reminder to me. And people forget how different early Pentecostals looked. And Pentecostals were essentially Anabaptist. If you look at early AG folks, women would not cut their hair; it'd be down to their ankles, no makeup. That it was a very pull back from the world. And I always say that tends to be why Pentecostals on TV today look like they just shoved their face in it, because they've come away from the age of law about what you wear and this type of stuff. What happened then is in the 50s and 60s, especially that style began to go into other parts of the Protestant world and then eventually the Catholic world. So in a varsity, there were some Anglican churches in California, and there were others that began to have what we call charismatic renewal experiences in their midst. And that has since gone on, by the way, to every major denomination that I can't think of an exception to this. You have all types of folks that would at least be charismatic small c, or at least a tolerant, allowing of that. They agree to disagree, whatever. Same in the Catholic Church. The way the Catholic Church, though, absorbs it is they incorporate it into much of the same way that medieval mysticism was. So there are lots of medieval mystics, Teresa of Avila and all these types, St. John of the Cross, he's more early modern, but still. There are a lot of these Dark Night of the Soul, the Interior Castle books that are very spiritual. And they are focused on the inward life, you might say. And there are actually monastic movements like the Carthusians, like the Carmelites and others that do this type of thing. I mean, you often hear about the vow of silence. That is actually a very spiritual, mystical movement where you're supposed to shut down and go inward. Unlike the Jesuits, which are very usually academic and about the mind, that kind of thing. What charismatic faith did is basically incorporate itself, into that. But as is the case in other denominations, it also dramatically lowered the talk of the papal magisterium, of all that loop stuff. It became about Jesus has come to me and I have this. It's basically pietism. I have an immediate knowledge that Jesus is my Lord. I don't have a window into their soul or their heart. I don't know. I'm not God. But I'm far more appreciative that they are more immediate with Christ in their experience, at least that's how they're describing it, than they are the other way. So in much of Catholicism in Africa, that's exactly what you're looking at. You have a very, and in South America as well, you have a very charismatic influence there. Yeah. Numbers are hard to come by off the top of my head, but it's pretty staggeringly high. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and by those you mean Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, those types of folks, yeah. So what effect do the American rise of cults have? Yeah. Yeah, beginning here and then going around the world. The short answer is, I think it was Harold Bloom that said there is no more quintessential American heresy than Mormonism. It's an individualistic, it's a works righteousness system where in the end you get to be your own deity. And he said that is the quintessential American individualism where you just spiral up. What Mormonism is an aberrant form of that holiness stuff that we're looking at, that I was talking about. It happens exactly at the same time. And hopefully you heard in that talk, the last one, just prior to this one, that the holiness movements have some good and things they're doing, but obviously there's some challenges. In the case of that, of course, you're seeing a kind of corrupting instinct there. And not only that, but of course, heresies along with it. But yeah, the challenge is they've gone global as well. What's striking, though, is they do not always, in some ways, particularly with Mormonism, it is so quintessentially American, the kind of the concern about things like caffeine or other types of things, the kind of moralism around it. You go to other parts of the world, either they, believe it or not, the moralism of the local community already beats that, and it's whether it's Buddhism or Hinduism or something like this. So it seems like you know, weak beer and stale bread compared to what they're already doing. Or what ends up happening is they get there and it's so imbued with kind of an Americana view of piety that it ends up not making any sense to them. So only in America is it the case where you say an abstinence from alcohol is a mark of holiness. And that's most denominations have usually somebody that feels that way. You almost never find that in most of the majority of the world. They're not, of course, into drunkenness, but that doesn't mean that they don't. Someone refraining from ever touching alcohol is not seen as necessarily a holy thing. It's just maybe a thing that's good for you. I don't know. But in that case, when Mormonism comes and it says, well, we don't do caffeine or alcohol, people are going, you don't do caffeine? Have you tasted tea? Like, you know, it doesn't signal caffeine holiness health to them. Because it took the holiness Wesleyan movements to actually inspire that as the model for holiness. So that's not to say that there aren't folks going around the world from the American, the Jehovah's Witness or the Mormon world. But by and large, you're not seeing deep-rooted, constant, like you're not seeing the explosion like you're seeing of the Christian faith, put it that way. Yeah. Okay, folks, it's been good to be with you. I won't keep any longer, but thank you for the invite. Thank you for being so attentive. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, and it's been great. Thank you.